Slavery. Nowhere have intellectuals seen racial issues as issues about intertemporal abstractions more so than in discussions of slavery. Moreover, few facts of history have been so distorted by highly selective filtering as has the history of slavery. To many people today, slavery means white people holding black people in bondage. The vast millions of people around the world who were neither white nor black, but who were either slaves or enslavers for centuries, fade out of this vision of slavery as if they had never existed, even though they may well have outnumbered both blacks and whites. It has been estimated that there were more slaves in India than in the entire Western Hemisphere. China, during the era of slavery, has been described as one of the largest and most comprehensive markets for the exchange of human beings in the world. Slaves were a majority of the population in some of the cities in Southeast Asia. At some period or other in history, as John Stuart Mill pointed out, almost every people, now civilized, have consisted, in majority, of slaves. When Abraham Lincoln said, "If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong," he was expressing an idea peculiar to Western civilization at that time, and by no means universally accepted throughout Western civilization. What seems almost incomprehensible today is that there was no serious challenge to the moral legitimacy of slavery prior to the 18th century. Christian monasteries in Europe and Buddhist monasteries in Asia both had slaves. Even Thomas More's fictional ideal society, Utopia, had slaves. Although intellectuals today may condemn slavery as a historic evil of our society, what was peculiar about Western society was not that it had slaves, like other societies around the world, but that it was the first civilization to turn against slavery, and that it spent more than a century destroying slavery, not only within Western civilization itself, but also in other countries around the world, over the often bitter and sometimes armed resistance of people in other societies. Only the overwhelming military power of Western nations during the age of imperialism made this possible. Slavery did not quietly die out of its own accord. It went down fighting to the bitter end in countries around the world, and it has still not totally died out to this day in parts of the Middle East and Africa. It is the image of racial slavery, white people enslaving black people, that has been indelibly burned into the consciousness of both black and white Americans today by the intelligentsia, and not simply as a fact about the past, but as a causal factor used to explain much of the present, and an enduring moral condemnation of the enslaving race. Yet two crucial facts have been filtered out of this picture. One, the institution of slavery was not based on race, and two, whites as well as blacks were enslaved. The very word slave is derived from the name of a European people, Slavs, who were enslaved for centuries before the first African was brought in bondage to the Western Hemisphere. It was not only in English that the word for slave derived from the word for Slav. The same was true in various other European languages and in Arabic. For most of the history of slavery, which covers most of the history of the human race, most slaves were not racially different from those who enslaved them. Not only did Europeans enslave Europeans, Asians enslaved other Asians, Africans enslaved other Africans, Polynesians enslaved other Polynesians, and the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere enslaved other indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere. Moreover, after it became both technologically and economically feasible to transport masses of slaves from one continent to another, that is, to have a whole population of slaves of a different race, Europeans as well as Africans were enslaved and transported from their native lands to bondage on another continent. Pirates alone transported a million Europeans as slaves to the Barbary coast of North Africa, at least twice as many European slaves as there were African slaves transported to the United States and to the 13 colonies from which it was formed. Moreover, white slaves were still being bought and sold in the Islamic world decades after blacks had been freed in the United States. What marked the modern era of slavery in the West was the fact that, as distinguished historian Daniel Boorstin pointed out, now, for the first time in Western history, the status of slave coincided with the difference of race. But to claim that race or racism was the basis of slavery is to cite as a cause something that happened thousands of years after its supposed effect. As for the legacy of slavery in the world of today, that is something well worth investigating, as distinguished from simply making sweeping assumptions. Too many assumptions that have been made about the effects of slavery on both blacks and whites will not stand up under scrutiny. Back during the era of slavery in the United States, such prominent writers as the French visitor and observer Alexis de Tocqueville, northern traveler in the antebellum South, Frederick Law Olmsted, and prominent southern writer Hinton Helper all pointed to striking differences between the North and the South, and attributed the deficiencies of the southern region to the effects of slavery on the white population of the South. These differences between northern and southern whites were not merely perceptions or stereotypes, they were factually demonstrable in areas ranging from literacy rates to rates of unwed motherhood, as well as in attitudes toward work and violence. But attributing these differences to slavery ignored the fact that the ancestors of white Southerners differed in these same ways from the ancestors of white Northerners, when they both lived in different parts of Britain and when neither had ever seen a black slave. Does the moral enormity of slavery give it any more decisive causal weight in explaining the situation of blacks today than it did in explaining that of whites in the antebellum South? There is no a priori answer to that question, which must be examined empirically, like many other questions. The fact that so many black families today consist of women with fatherless children has been said by many to be a legacy of slavery. Yet most black children grew up in two-parent families, even under slavery itself, and for generations thereafter. As recently as 1960, two-thirds of black children were still living in two-parent families. A century ago, a slightly higher percentage of blacks were married than were whites. In some years, a slightly higher percentage of blacks were in the labor force than were whites. The reasons for changes for the worse in these and other patterns must be sought in our own times. Whatever the reasons for the disintegration of the black family, it escalated to the current disastrous level well over a century after the end of slavery, though less than a generation after a large expansion of the welfare state and its accompanying non-judgmental ideology. To say that slavery will not bear the full weight of responsibility for all subsequent social problems among black Americans is not to say that it had negligible consequences among either blacks or whites, or that its consequences ended when slavery itself ended. But this is only to say that answers to questions about either slavery or race must be sought in facts, not in assumptions or visions, and certainly not in attempts to reduce questions of causation to only those which provide moral melodramas and an opportunity for the intelligentsia to be on the side of the angels. Just as Western Europeans in post-Roman times benefited from the fact that their ancestors had been conquered by the Romans, with all the brutality and oppression that entailed, blacks in America today have a far higher standard of living than most Africans in Africa as a result of their ancestors being enslaved, with all the injustices and abuses that entailed. There is no question that both conquest and enslavement were traumatic experiences for those on whom they were inflicted, nor is either morally justified by whatever benefits might come of this to subsequent generations of their offspring. But history cannot be undone, nor does conceiving of races as intertemporal abstractions have any such track record as to make it look like a promising approach to the present or the future. Race and crime. The intelligentsia's feats of verbal virtuosity reach their heights, or depths, when discussing the crime rate among blacks in America. For example, New York Times columnist Tom Wicker responded to an incident in which a white woman jogging in Central Park was gang-raped by black youths by denying that this was a racially motivated crime. Wicker said, "The fact that the victim was white and the attackers black does not seem to have caused the crime." He added, "But if race does not explain this crime, race was relevant to it. The attackers lived surrounded and surely influenced by the social pathologies of the inner city. They hardly could have reached teenage without realizing and resenting the wide economic and social gap that still separates blacks and whites in this country, and they could not fail to see, and probably return, the hostility that glares at them undisguised across that gap. These influences are bound to have had some consequences, perhaps long repressed, probably not realized or understood, in their attitudes and behavior. The wide economic and social gap between blacks and whites that Wicker referred to was even wider in earlier years, when it was common for whites to go up to Harlem at night for public entertainment or private parties, and common for both blacks and whites to sleep out in the city's parks on hot summer nights during an era when most people could not afford air conditioning. But sleeping in parks, or in some cases, even walking through some of those same parks in broad daylight, became dangerous in later and more prosperous times. Yet here, as elsewhere, the prevailing vision often seems impervious to even the plainest facts. The role played by many people who, like Tom Wicker himself, have incessantly emphasized gaps and disparities as injustices to be resented, rather than lags to be overcome, is seldom considered to be among the candidates for inclusion among the root causes of crime, even though the rise of crime is far more consistent with the increasing prevalence of such grievance and resentment ideologies than with other things that are considered to be root causes, such as poverty levels, which have been declining as crime rates rose. Resentments based on ideologies of cosmic justice are not confined to the intelligentsia, but trickle down to others. For example, right after charges of gang rape of a black woman were filed against white students on Duke University's lacrosse team in 2006, angry reactions from a black college in the same town reflected that same vision, as reported in Newsweek. Across town at NCCU, the mostly black college where the alleged victim is enrolled, students seemed bitterly resigned to the players beating the rap. "This is a race issue," said Candace Shaw, 20. "People at Duke have a lot of money on their side," Chan Hall, 22, said. "It's the same old story. Duke up, Central down." Hall said he wanted to see the Duke students prosecuted, whether it happened or not. "It would be justice for things that happened in the past." Implicit in these statements are the key elements of the cosmic justice vision of the intelligentsia, seeing other people's good fortune as a grievance, rather than an incentive for self-improvement, and seeing flesh-and-blood contemporaries as simply part of an intertemporal abstraction, so that a current injustice against them would merely offset other injustices of the past. There could hardly be a more deadly inspiration for a never-ending cycle of revenge and counter-revenge, the Hatfields and the McCoys writ large, with a whole society caught in the crossfire. The built-in excuse has become as standard in discussions of black crime as it is unsubstantiated, except by peer consensus among the intelligentsia. The phrase "troubled youth" is a common example of the unsubstantiated but built-in excuse, since those who use that phrase usually feel no need to offer any specific evidence about the specific individuals they are talking about, who may be creating big trouble for others while enjoying themselves in doing so. An all-too-common pattern across the country was that in an episode in Milwaukee. Shayna Perry remembers the punch to her face, blood streaming from a cut over her eye, her backpack with her asthma inhaler, debit card, and cell phone stolen, and then the laughter. "They just said, 'Oh, white girl bleeds a lot,'" said Perry, 22, who was attacked at Kilburn Reservoir Park over the 4th of July weekend. Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn noted Tuesday that crime is colorblind. "I saw some of my friends on the ground getting beat pretty severely." Perry needed 3 stitches to close a cut above her eye. She said she saw a friend getting kicked, and when she walked up to ask what was happening, a man punched her in the face. "I heard laughing as they were beating everybody up. They were eating chips like it was a picnic," said Perry, a restaurant cashier. Most of the 11 people who told the Journal Sentinel they were attacked or witnessed the attacks on their friends said that police did not take their complaints seriously. About 20 of us stayed to give statements and make sure everyone was accounted for. The police wouldn't listen to us. They wouldn't take our names or statements. They told us to leave. It was completely infuriating. Variations on such episodes of unprovoked violence by young black gangs against white people on beaches, in shopping malls, or in other public places have occurred in Philadelphia, New York, Denver, Chicago, Cleveland, Washington, Los Angeles, and other places across the country, often with the attackers voicing anti-white invective and mocking those they left injured or bleeding. But such episodes are often either ignored or downplayed in most of the media, and by officials, and the Chicago Tribune even offered an excuse for not reporting the race of the attackers in a series of such episodes that alarmed the Chicago public. Yet race is widely reported when it comes to imprisonment rates or other racial disparities. For example, in March of 2010, Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan delivered a speech that highlighted racial disparities in school suspension and expulsion, and that called for more rigorous civil rights enforcement in education. He suggested that students with disabilities and black students, especially males, were suspended far more often than their white counterparts. These students, he also noted, were often punished more severely for similar misdeeds. Just months later, in September of 2010, a report analyzing 2006 data collected by the U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights found that more than 28% of black male middle school students had been suspended at least once. This is nearly three times the 10% rate for white males. Further, 18% of black females in middle school were suspended, more than four times as often as white females, 4%. Later that same month, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Secretary Duncan each addressed a conference of civil rights lawyers in Washington, D.C., and affirmed their department's commitment to ending such disparities. The very possibility that there might be behavioral differences behind the punishment differences does not surface in such discussions. To believe that there are no behavioral differences between black and white school-age males is to assume that the large and undeniable differences in crime rates, including murder rates, between black and white young adults suddenly and inexplicably materialize after they finish school. Professor David D. Cole of the Georgetown University Law School expressed views similar to those of Tom Wicker and many others among the intelligentsia of the multicultural era, when he lamented the increasing imprisonment of black men. In the 1950s, when segregation was still legal, African Americans comprised 30% of the prison population. 60 years later, African Americans and Latinos make up 70% of the incarcerated population, and that population has skyrocketed. The disparities are greatest where race and class intersect. Nearly 60% of all young black men born between 1965 and 1969 who dropped out of high school went to prison at least once on a felony conviction before they turned 35. Professor Cole posed the issue explicitly in the cosmic justice terms of John Rawls. Were we in John Rawls' original position, with no idea whether we would be born a black male in an impoverished urban home, would we accept a system in which one out of every three black males born today can expect to spend time in jail during his life? The preemptive assertion in passing that it is the system, something external, created by others in the larger society, that is the cause of the problem, arbitrarily puts off limits at the outset the very possibility that the problem may be elsewhere. By sheer verbal virtuosity, rather than by any facts or evidence, collective responsibility is put on those in the larger society. There is clearly something in the circumstances into which many black males are born that makes it far more likely that they will commit crimes than is true of the population in general, including the majority of the black population that does not end up behind bars. But that tells us absolutely nothing about what that something is. If it is being impoverished, then clearly there is a lot less poverty today than in 1950, when the imprisonment rate among black males was lower, even though invoking poverty remains at least as much a part of the rituals, as distinguished from arguments, of intellectuals today as then. Professor Cole adds some other statistics that only 5% of college-educated African Americans have spent time in prison, while the imprisonment rate for black male high school dropouts is nearly 50 times the national average. He also notes, children with parents in prison are in turn 7 times more likely to be imprisoned at some point in their lives than other children. None of this supports the claim that the cause is an external system, as asserted by Professor Cole, rather than an internal counterproductive culture, perhaps aided and abetted by outsiders who excuse or even celebrate that counterproductive underclass culture, an underclass culture which has produced very similar results among lower-class whites in Britain, where similar ideologies of envy and resentment have long been promoted by the British intelligentsia. Both in Britain and in the United States, as well as in other countries, there has been a steady ideological drumbeat of rhetoric from intellectuals depicting gaps and disparities as grievances against those who are better off. In both Britain and America, this resentment and hostility generated by the intelligentsia has been directed by those who accept it, not only against members of the larger society, but also against those members of their own group who are working to do well in school in order to have a better life later on. What is truly remarkable in its implications is the contrast between the higher rate of imprisonment among young men in the black ghettos of America today compared to the 1950s, and how that undermines the very argument in which these imprisonment rates are cited. Surely, the supposed root causes of crime, poverty, discrimination, and the like, were not less in the 1950s, before the civil rights laws and policies of the 1960s. And what of those blacks who do not drop out of high school, but who go on to college instead, and seldom end up in prison? It should also be noted that, from 1994 on into the 21st century, the poverty rate among black husband-wife families was below 10%. Are these blacks living in a different external system, or do they have a different internal culture, representing different values in their families, or among others who have influenced them? Yet such questions are seldom asked, much less answered. Instead, today's higher rate of incarceration is blamed on drug laws, tighter sentencing rules, and a general failure of society. In short, society is to blame, except apparently for those members of society who actually commit the crimes. But whatever the reasons for the higher crime rate now than then, or between blacks and whites, it is indeed a tragic injustice, from a cosmic perspective, to be born into circumstances that make it more likely that one will commit crimes and be imprisoned, with negative consequences for the rest of one's life. If some personified fate had decreed this, then that would be the perpetrator of the injustice. But if this is just part of the way the world has evolved, then it is a cosmic injustice, if something as impersonal as the cosmos can be considered capable of being unjust. As noted in Chapter 4, a cosmic injustice is not a social injustice, and proceeding as if society has both the omniscience and the omnipotence to solve the problem risks antisocial justice, in which others are jeopardized or sacrificed in hopes of putting some particular segment of the population where they would be but for being born into adverse circumstances that they did not choose. It is certainly no benefit to blacks in general to take a sympathetic view of those blacks who commit crimes, since most of the crimes committed by blacks, especially murder, are committed against other blacks. Whatever the injustices of society that might be blamed as root causes of crime, the black victims of crime are not responsible for those injustices. Here especially, social justice in theory becomes anti-social justice in practice, sacrificing innocent people's well-being, or even their lives, because some other individuals are considered not to have been born into circumstances that would have given them as good a chance as others have had to achieve their own well-being without becoming criminals. Moreover, it is wholly arbitrary to imagine oneself in Rawl's original position as a potential black criminal, rather than as one of the far more numerous blacks who are victims of criminals. Those who say that we should do something seldom face the fact that everything depends on just what specifically that something is. Being lenient with criminals has not worked. Relieving poverty has not reduced crime. And certainly being non-judgmental has not done so either. Crime rates skyrocketed when all these things were tried, whether among blacks or whites, and whether in America or in England. The automatic celebration of cultural differences, or the non-judgmental view of socially counterproductive behavior, for example, cannot be continued if the goal is to improve the well-being of actual flesh-and-blood people rather than seeking cosmic justice for an intertemporal abstraction. One can be humane or inhumane only to living people, not to abstractions.
White liberals. White liberals in many roles, as intellectuals, politicians, celebrities, judges, teachers, have aided and abetted the perpetuation of a counterproductive and self-destructive lifestyle among black rednecks. The welfare state has made it economically possible to avoid many of the painful consequences of this lifestyle that forced previous generations of blacks and whites to move away from the redneck culture and its values. Lax law enforcement has enabled the violent and criminal aspects of this culture to persist, and non-judgmental intellectual trends have enabled it to escape moral condemnation. As far back as 1901, W.E.B. Du Bois, while complaining of racial discrimination against blacks, also condemned indiscriminate charity for its bad effects within the black community. In a later era, the burgeoning welfare state, especially since the 1960s, has spread an indiscriminate charity in both money and attitudes that has given the black redneck culture a new lease on life. Intellectuals have been particularly prominent among those who have turned the black redneck culture into a sacrosanct symbol of racial identity. This includes both black and white intellectuals, though the latter predominate numerically and in terms of influence through the media and academia. Intellectuals have promoted misconceptions of history, misreadings of contemporary life, and counterproductive notions of how to prepare for the future. By projecting a vision of a world in which the problems of blacks are consequences of the actions of whites, either immediately or in times past, white liberals have provided a blanket excuse for shortcomings and even crimes by blacks. The very possibility of any internal cultural sources of the problems of blacks have been banished from consideration by the fashionable phrase, blaming the victim. But no one can be blamed for being born into a culture that evolved in centuries past, even though moving beyond such a culture may do more for future advancement than blaming others or seeking special dispensations. Blaming others. Blaming others for anything in which blacks lag has become standard operating procedure among white liberals. If blacks do not pass bar exams or medical board tests as often as whites or Asians, then that shows that something is wrong with those tests, as far as many white liberals are concerned. Best-selling author Andrew Hacker, for example, says that academic problems in general are created for black students in white colleges because such colleges use curricula that are white in logic and learning, in their conceptions of scholarly knowledge and demeanor. Why this does not seem to be a problem for Asian students remains unexplained, even though blacks have lived in this white society for centuries longer than either Asian Americans or contemporary immigrants from Asia. Why it is not a problem for blacks from the Caribbean is another unexplained contradiction of such white liberal excuses for American-born blacks. If black attorneys are not elevated to partnerships and law firms in proportion to their numbers, then to the New York Times this shows, in the words of their front page headline, "Law firms are slow in promoting minority lawyers to partner role." Apparently, there can only be external reasons for anything negative that happens to blacks. According to Andrew Hacker, the fact that white taxi drivers often pass up black males seeking a ride, especially at night, shows these drivers to be patently racist, even though black taxi drivers do the same, in order to avoid becoming victims of crime. White liberals long denied that there were higher crime rates among blacks by pointing to the imperfections of crime statistics in general, or, more specifically, claiming that blacks are simply arrested more often for things that whites would not be arrested for. But if the imperfections of crime statistics were the real problem, then discussions could be limited to murder statistics, since dead bodies are not ignored, whether they are black or white, and neither are murderers, whatever their race. But murder statistics show the same disproportionate number of crimes by blacks as other statistics do. While murder statistics might provide more accuracy, they would not provide white liberals with a means of evading the obvious. Riots by blacks are almost automatically blamed on whites, whether in the Kerner Report on the riots of the 1960s or in the reactions among white liberals to the Los Angeles riots of 1992. In some white liberal circles, the New York Times, for example, the police are almost automatically at fault in confrontations with black criminals, hoodlums, or rioters. When the police arrive on a scene of crime or violence in black communities, whatever they do is likely to be categorized later as either having let the situation get out of hand or as having used excessive force. Any force sufficient to prevent the situation from getting out of hand is almost certain to be called excessive force by white liberals in the media, so that, by definition, the police will have acted badly, no matter what they did or failed to do. Should the police arrive in such overwhelming numbers as to bring the disorder to a quick halt without any need to use force at all, then they will often be said to have overreacted by sending so many cops to deal with unresisting people. One of the reactions of the police to such predictable scapegoating in the media has been to depolice some of the most violent black neighborhoods, looking the other way rather than risk seeing a whole career ruined by media charges of racism. This gives criminals, hoodlums, and rioters a freer hand at the expense of law-abiding blacks, who may be the great majority, even in a high-crime neighborhood. There is evidence that this is in fact what happens after a barrage of adverse media coverage against the police. The incorrigibility of white society and the corresponding futility of black efforts to improve their situation by improving their own education and other qualifications is another leitmotif of much white liberal writing. After the U.S. Supreme Court struck down some racially gerrymandered congressional districts, forcing some black members of Congress to run in districts where most voters were white, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis said, "The reality in the South is that black men and women, however well qualified, have little chance of winning in white districts." But these Southern black candidates were in fact reelected. The fact that black rednecks exhibit the same hostility and violence toward other minorities, long associated with bigoted white rednecks in the South, presents white liberals with another challenge to find a way to evade the obvious. Black anti-Semitism, for example, is not recognized by Andrew Hacker, who claims that no one really knows if blacks and whites differ markedly in their feelings about Jews, despite survey after survey showing greater hostility to Jews among blacks. Black hostility to other minorities, such as the Koreans, has likewise often been ignored by such liberal publications as the New York Times, or even defined out of existence by a variety of white liberal writers on grounds that racism requires power, which blacks do not have. Following that logic, Nazis were not anti-Semites until they gained control of the German government, and the Ku Klux Klan today would not be called racist anymore because it has lost the power it once had. But the arbitrary proviso of power was never part of the definition of racism until racism among blacks became widespread enough to require a convenient evasion. The thuggish gutter words and brutal hoodlum lifestyle of gangsta rap musicians are not merely condoned but glorified by many white intellectuals and understood by others lacking the courage to take responsibility for siding with savagery. The National Council of Teachers urged the use of hip-hop in urban classrooms. The cultural editor of the San Francisco Chronicle characterized rapper Tupac Shakur as a lightning rod of insurrection in the name of social justice. USA Today said, "Gangster rap is rooted in part in underfunded school systems which fail to equip students with the skills to speak out effectively and intersect with larger communities." An article in the New Republic said that rap music has become the nearest thing to a political voice of the poor. Michael Gilmore of Rolling Stone wrote of all the terrible forces responsible for such a wasteful, unjustifiable end to the life of rapper Tupac Shakur by the very lawless violence he had sung of and lived, not by some mysterious forces. The blaming of gangster rap barbarism on social conditions takes many forms, such as that of a Boston Globe columnist who depicted it as deriving from the institutional indifference that thrives wherever poor people assemble in America. Struggling schools, dangerous streets, long-gone factories, hospital emergency rooms or EMTs substituting for family doctors, futures measured by sunsets and sunrises, and the dull feeling that nearly everything is against you. A New York Times essay dismissing critics of gangster rap referred to the poverty and hopelessness that foster vicious behavior. The general orientation of white liberals has been one of what can we do for them? What blacks can do for themselves has not only been of lesser interest, much of what blacks have in fact already done for themselves has been overshadowed by liberal attempts to get them special dispensations, whether affirmative action, reparations for slavery, or other race-based benefits, even when the net effect of these dispensations has been much less than the effects of blacks' own self-advancement. For example, although the greatest reduction in poverty among blacks occurred before the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s, the liberal vision in which black lags are explained by white oppression requires black advances to be explained by the fight against such oppression, symbolized by the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. This scenario has been repeated so often through so many channels that it has become a well-known fact by sheer repetition. Moreover, this protest and government action model has become the liberals' preferred, if not universal, model for future black advancement. Misconceptions of history. Many of the prevailing misconceptions of the histories of both blacks and whites in America derive from trying to amalgamate morality and causation so as to make the moral evil of slavery a causal explanation of contemporary negative social phenomena, which have in fact had entirely different historical bases. The touchy pride of white Southerners, ready to explode into deadly violence, has often been explained as being a result of whites being used to unbridled domination over slaves. But the very same attitudes existed among their ancestors in Britain, where slavery did not exist, as those attitudes also existed in those parts of the South where slaves were virtually non-existent, and among people who were in no economic condition to buy slaves. When discussing both blacks and Southern whites, slavery has served as an all-purpose explanation of many social phenomena, ranging from broken families to poor education, lower labor force participation rates, and high rates of crime and violence. Often, evidence has been neither asked for nor given. Not surprisingly, many of these explanations do not stand up under scrutiny. Census data, for example, show that labor force participation rates were higher among non-whites than among whites in 1920 and 1930. No matter what the origin of counterproductive behavior, such behavior must be changed if progress is the goal. On the other hand, if the real agenda is to score points against American society, then blacks can be used as a means to that end. More generally, a pro-black stance by white intellectuals enhances the latter's moral standing and self-esteem, whether or not the particular manifestation of that stance helps or harms blacks on net balance. The chafing restrictions of civilization, which can at times become irksome to people of any color, may be vicariously thrown off by those white intellectuals who cheer on outlandish and even lawless behavior by black hoodlums or entertainers. Blacks, in effect, become the mascots of these intellectuals, symbolizing and acting out the latter's resistance to society, or more accurately, civilization. But, while mascots may be indulged, more fundamentally, mascots exist for the sake of those who adopt them, and the actual well-being of the mascot is seldom a high priority. By cheering on counterproductive attitudes, making excuses for self-defeating behavior, and promoting the belief that racism accounts for most of blacks' problems, white intellectuals serve their own psychic, ideological, and political interests. They are the kinds of friends who can do more harm than enemies. A crucial fact about white liberals must be kept in mind. They are not simply in favor of blacks in general. Their solicitude is poured out for blacks as victims, blacks as welfare mothers, criminals, political activists against the larger society, as well as those blacks who serve as general countercultural symbols against the larger society. White liberals have nothing approaching the same interest in blacks as the principal victims of black criminals or as people advancing themselves within the existing framework of American society, including many who have risen within the military. Nor do they get particularly worked up over blacks who build up their own human capital or business capital. None of the many reports of black schools that excel academically seems to arouse any great interest among white liberals. It was not the liberals in Washington, but the Reagan administration, which offered successful black educator Marva Collins an appointment as Secretary of Education.
Although science is capable of linear advancement, the same is not true of law, where the same insights and mistakes tend to recur again and again. Richard A. Epstein. The law is one of the many arenas in which the ideological conflict of visions is fought out. Just as a free market economy puts severe limits on the role to be played by the vision of the intellectuals, so too does strict adherence to the rule of law, especially constitutional law. To those whose vision casts a knowledgeable elite in the role of surrogate decision-makers for society at large, the law must have very different characteristics from what it has in the vision of those who see the vast majority of consequential knowledge scattered among millions of people, with no given individual having more than a minute fraction of that knowledge. If the law depends on the knowledge, wisdom, and virtue of surrogate decision-makers, then it is easy to imagine that it is up to those decision-makers to shape laws that are fair, compassionate, or guided by a sense of social justice. But since these are all undefined words, malleable in the hands of those with verbal virtuosity, such a concept of law is wholly incompatible with the kind of law desired by those who wish the law to provide a dependable framework of rules, within which independent decisions can be made by millions of people working out their mutual accommodations among themselves. There can be no dependable framework of law where judges are free to impose as law their own individual notions of what is fair, compassionate, or in accord with social justice. Whatever the merits or demerits of particular judges' conceptions of these terms, they cannot be known in advance to others, nor uniform from one judge to another, so that they are not law in the full sense of rules known in advance to those subject to those rules. The Constitution of the United States explicitly forbids ex post facto laws, so that citizens cannot be punished or held liable for actions which were not illegal when those actions took place. But judges making decisions on the basis of their own conceptions of fairness, compassion, or social justice are, in effect, creating laws after the fact, which those subject to such laws could not have known in advance. Here, as in so many other situations, the fatal step is in going beyond one's expertise. While judges have specialized knowledge and skills in determining where the law sets the boundaries of citizens' discretion, that is wholly different from having judges become second-guessers as to how citizens exercise whatever discretion belongs to them within those boundaries. Individuals may, for example, choose to take on the responsibilities of marriage or to live together without taking on those responsibilities. But judges who have awarded palimony to one of the partners after a breakup have, in effect, retroactively forced the responsibilities of marriage on people who had in effect agreed to avoid those responsibilities when they decided to live together without availing themselves of this well-known institution. The consequences can spread far beyond the particular cases or the particular issues in those cases. The wider penumbra of uncertainty around all laws, when judges indulge their own notions, encourages increased litigation by those who have no real case under the law as written, but who may be able to extort concessions from those they sue, who may not be willing to risk some judge's imaginative interpretation of the law. Changing the law. Laws must, of course, change as conditions change in society, but there is a fundamental difference between laws that change by the electorate deciding to vote for officials who will pass new legislation that will then become laws announced in advance, versus laws changed individually by judges who inform those standing before them in court how the judge's new interpretation applies to them. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous statement, "The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience," was more than a judgment about history. It was part of his judicial philosophy. In one of his U.S. Supreme Court opinions, he said, Tradition and the habits of the community count for more than logic. The plaintiff must wait until there is a change of practice, or at least an established consensus of civilized opinion, before it can expect this court to overthrow the rules that the lawmakers and the court of his own state uphold. While relying more on the evolved experience of generations, embodied in law, as against the reasoning of intellectuals, Holmes did not deny that some great intellects had made contributions to the development of the law, the greatest of which, he added, is trifling when compared with the mighty whole. But if the systemic evolution of the law as conceived by Holmes has not been so much a matter of intellect as of wisdom, a wisdom distilled from the experiences of whole generations rather than from the brilliance or presumptions of an intellectual elite, then intellectuals who seek more than a trifling role have little choice but to try to create a very different kind of law, one more suited to their own particular endowments and aspirations. That has, in fact, been the thrust of those with the vision of the anointed for more than two centuries. In the 18th century, the Marquis de Condorcet took a view of the law opposite to that later taken by Holmes, and more consonant with that of the 20th century intelligentsia. Laws are better formulated and appear less often to be the vague product of circumstance and caprice. They are made by learned men, if not yet by philosophers. By the second half of the 20th century, the view of law as something to be deliberately shaped according to the spirit of the times, as interpreted by intellectual elites, became more common in the leading law schools and among judges. Professor Ronald Dworkin of Oxford University epitomized this approach when he dismissed the systemic evolution of the law as a silly faith based on the chaotic and unprincipled development of history, systemic processes being equated with chaos, as they have been among those who promoted central economic planning rather than the systemic interactions of markets. In both cases, the preference has been for an elite to impose its vision, overriding, if necessary, the views of the masses of their fellow citizens. For Dworkin also said, "A more equal society is a better society, even if its citizens prefer inequality." In short, this vision has sought to impose social and economic equality through a political inequality that would allow an elite to override what the population at large wants. Despite Professor Dworkin's claim, it hardly seems likely that most people really prefer inequality. What they may prefer is the freedom that systemic processes permit, rather than elite dictation, even if those systemic processes entail a certain amount of economic inequality. Law, in the full sense of rules known in advance and applied as written, is a major restriction on surrogate decision-making, especially when it is constitutional law, not readily changed by a simple majority of the moment. Those with the vision of the anointed must either chafe under such restrictions or else use their talents, including verbal virtuosity, to loosen the restrictions of law on government officials, which is to say, they must make law less than law and more in the nature of ad hoc decision-making by empowered elites. That has, in fact, long been the general direction taken by intellectuals who favor surrogate decision-making in general and by government officials seeking greater scope for the exercise of their power.
Blacks, the only thing standing between the Democratic Party and oblivion. To the casual observer, Democrats seem hell-bent on pushing blacks out of their party. Hey, didn't Hispanics just become the largest minority group? What a weird coincidence. Democrats see blacks not as individuals, but as a voting bloc, and a not particularly bright voting bloc. Endlessly repeating the myth that will not die, in the 2000 presidential campaign, Al Gore used the three-fifths of a person argument when he was running for president to claim that our forefathers thought blacks didn't count as a full person. As any idiot knows, it was the anti-slavery framers who didn't want to count blacks as full persons in determining congressional representation. This constitutional provision had nothing to do with slavery. It simply determined congressional apportionment. If blacks counted as full persons, the slave-owning states would have overwhelmed the Congress. And yet you hear about the three-fifths clause on Air America approximately once a week, as if it were a sop to racist Southerners. The slave-holding Southern states would have loved to count blacks as five people. That would have massively increased their power in Congress. Before attacking conservative blacks, liberals run to the NAACP like they're going to a judge for a warrant. Can we attack Clarence Thomas and J.C. Watts for being stupid? Yes, sure, let me sign the warrant. Dusting off the playbook from the Clarence Thomas nomination, Democrats disparaged every single black person in authority throughout the Bush administration, generally with nasty insinuations about their intelligence and competence. Blacks were treated to a very special round of condescension in 2004 when liberals were disconsolate over some unwarranted criticism of a cartoon sponge and decided to take it out on the blacks. Richard Clark claimed in his Bush-bashing book, Against All Enemies, that when he briefed Condoleezza Rice on al-Qaeda, she looked perplexed, which he interpreted to mean that she had never heard of al-Qaeda. Although Rice had been talking about al-Qaeda for years, this struck the media as a totally believable charge. Sorry, Condi, you failed the literacy test. The next year, in 2005, the Democrats did not name Donna Brazile, one of three remaining intelligent blacks in the entire party, and an African-American, to head the Democratic National Committee. Instead, Democrats chose the goofy wasp in the green pants, Howard Dean. You couldn't even say, yes, but look at all Dean has done for blacks. Democrats simply use blacks for their votes and as stalking horses for the causes liberals actually care about, like abortion and women's rights. They love invoking the majestic phrase, civil rights, without allowing follow-up questions. When Democrats start claiming a Republican is bad on civil rights, I promise you it has nothing to do with blacks. In the 1998 Maryland gubernatorial race, for example, Democrats ran an ad exclusively in black neighborhoods claiming that Republican candidate Ellen Sowerby had a civil rights record to be ashamed of. The alleged civil rights bill that Sowerby had voted against, along with a majority of the Maryland legislature, had nothing to do with blacks. It was a sexual harassment bill. This would be hard to ascertain from the ad, which showed pictures of sad black people. Democrats love the racist smear, but don't have much interest in promoting actual black people within the Democratic Party. Democrats won't even listen to them. When civil rights heroes supported the nomination of Judge Charles Pickering to a federal appeals court, Democrats ignored them, deferring instead to the hysterical denunciations of Judge Pickering by People for the American Way, based in Malibu. According to liberals living in New York and California, but no black person living in Mississippi, Pickering was a racist. Pickering testified against the Klan when he was a young prosecutor in Mississippi, putting his life in danger. He worked with the FBI to stop Klan violence. Unlike any current or former member of People for the American Way, Pickering sent his children to majority black schools. His nomination was supported by several past presidents of the NAACP in Mississippi, and apparently every black person who had ever set foot in Mississippi. But liberals ginned up a phony complaint about Pickering based on a single ruling in which he reduced a wildly disproportionate 7-year sentence for a cross-burner who wasn't even the ringleader but happened to be stupid enough to be set up as the fall guy. Pickering, a civil rights hero, was smeared as a racist in order to save abortion. Rich white women have suffered so much, more than blacks apparently. I know that from listening to Democrats. Democrats don't care about race discrimination. They're the party of race discrimination. George Wallace, Bull Connor, Bob Byrd, all Democrats. In light of their reaction to the nomination of Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, I gather liberals have gotten over their enthusiasm for multiculturalist milestones. It's interesting that they dropped their celebrations of the first woman, first black, first Asian designations at the precise moment that we are about to get our first black female Secretary of State. When Madeleine Albright was appointed the first woman Secretary of State, the media was euphoric. And if memory serves, Monica Lewinsky was the first Jewish female to occupy her various positions on the president's staff. What Democrats mean by civil rights is the civil right of a woman not to inform her husband she's aborting his baby, the civil right of a minor to have an abortion without notifying her parents, the civil right of a woman to plunge a fork in the head of a child as it struggles through the birth canal because it has a cleft lip. That's civil rights. The John Kerry campaign is hemorrhaging black voters like teenage girls fleeing an R. Kelly house party. Kerry waited for complaints that the only black people in his campaign were setting up folding chairs at rallies before finding blacks for any prominent positions. Another campaign slogan, John Kerry, pretending to fight for blacks since very recently. Liberals are going to have to figure out a way to cut Condoleezza Rice out of all the pictures. It's going to be like Stalinist Russia. Say, who's that black woman standing next to Bush? Oh, never mind, it's probably someone he's arresting. It's the maid. The gravest danger facing most black Americans today is the risk of being patronized to death. Clinton actually compares his battle against impeachment to civil rights struggles in the South. Haven't blacks been insulted enough by the constant comparison between gay marriage and black civil rights without this horny hick comparing his impeachment to Selma? If we can get blacks to be conservatives, we'll have an entire race of Ann Coulters. They do not care about politically correct. Crime and punishment, preferably a two-step process. The Democratic base is constantly in a state of indignation about the fact that criminals often end up in prison. It's as if the 60s, 70s, and 80s never happened. No matter how spectacular the failure of liberal crime policies in the past, the Democratic Party base has plans to overhaul the criminal justice system as soon as they get back into power. Beware, these people have a to-do list. Right after making sure abortions are legal up to the 40th trimester, they plan to empty the prisons so liberal busybodies can start addressing the root causes of crime. Though it has never worked in the past, liberals believe we must understand criminals in order to address the problem of crime. In other areas, understanding motives is not so important to liberals. How about the Holocaust? What made this Hitler guy tick, I wonder? What motivated him? You don't just kill 6 million Jews for no reason. And if understanding a criminal's motive is so important, why aren't we told exactly what the rape victim was wearing? Wouldn't that go a long way to helping us understand the rapist's motive? How about attacks on gays? Maybe gay bashers are just tired of being told they have no sense of style. You know how sarcastic gay guys can be. Only in the case of violent criminals, other than un-PC criminals, are liberals driven by this weird obsession of understanding the perpetrator's motive. I don't recall any liberals wanting to understand Ken Lay. They held candlelight vigils for Ted Bundy and Tukey Williams, but rejoiced when Ken Lay died. If only we could get liberals to hate child molesters and cop killers as much as they hate Ken Lay, we might be able to trust them with crime policy. Maybe we could get liberals to support the death penalty by telling them it's only for white-collar criminals. Liberals believe no punishment is too unusual or too cruel for rich guys engaged in insider trading. I think it's cruel and unusual to have to listen to sanctimonious B-list actors tell us how compassionate they are for opposing the death penalty. Surely we can all agree, that's too cruel even for Ken Lay. If the death penalty doesn't deter murder, how come Michael Moore is still alive and I'm not on death row? LBJ's Attorney General Ramsey Clark believed it was the government's job to rehabilitate violent criminals, not to keep them away from the public. Prisons, Clark said, are usually little more than places to keep people. Yes, I think that's the idea in a nutshell. Liberals complain that we're the only modern democracy with the death penalty. I think that should be treated as a selling point. Come to the United States for the economic opportunity. Stay because we fry our Ted Bundys. The proposition that prison doesn't work is like saying deodorant doesn't work, which college liberals also seem to believe. Of course prison works. It keeps people who commit crimes off the streets because they're in prison. Let's run the numbers. The recidivism rate of armed robbers behind bars is, looks like 0%. Liberals have an irreducible fascination with barbarism and will defend anything hateful. Tukey, Mumia, Saddam Hussein, Hedda Nussbaum, abortion, the North American Man-Boy Love Association, New York Times columnist Frank Rich. Needless to say, the death penalty is always verboten, except in the narrow case of Enron executives or clothing designers who use fur. I like how all the same criminal defense attorneys go from defending OJ to defending Clinton to defending Saddam Hussein. The only cop the New York Times likes is the one in the Village People.